The Worm Ouroboros by E. R. Edison. Chapter 7, Part 2. Now was the afternoon wearing to evening, when the Prince Lafayrie's was come in with all his company, and greetings done, and the tribute safe bestowed, and sleeping-room appointed for him and his. And now, all gathered together in the great banquet-hall that was built by Gorais the 11th, when he was first made king, in the southeast corner of the palace. And it far exceeded, in greatness and magnificence, the old hall, where Lord Jus and Lord Brandoc de Ha were held in duress. 7 equal walls it had, of dark green jasper specked with bloody spots. In the midst of one wall was the lofty doorway, and in the walls right and left of this, and in those that enclosed the angle opposite the door, were great windows placed high, giving light to the banquet hall. In each of the 7 angles of the wall, a caryatid, cut in the likeness of a 3-headed giant from ponderous blocks of black serpentine, bowed beneath the mass of a monstrous crab, hewn out of the same stone. The mighty claws of those 7 crabs, spreading upwards, bear up the dome of the roof, that was smooth and covered all over with paintings of battles and hunting scenes and wrestling bouts in dark and smoky colors, answerable to the gloomy grandeur of that chamber. On the walls, beneath the windows, gleamed weapons of war and of the chase. And on the 2 blind walls were nailed up, all orderly, the skulls and dead bones of those champions which had wrestled aforetime with King Gorais the 11th, or ever he appointed in an evil hour, to wrestle with Goldry Blushko. Across the innermost angle facing the door was a long table and a carven bench behind it, and from the 2 ends of that table, set square with it, 2 other tables yet longer, and benches by them on the sides next the wall, stretched within a short space of the door. Midmost of the table to the right of the door was a high seat of old cypress wood, great and fair, with cushions of black velvet broidered with gold, and facing it at the opposite table another high seat, smaller, and the cushions of it sewn with silver. In the space betwixt the tables, 5 iron braziers, massive and footed with claws like an eagle's, stood in a row, and behind the benches on either side were 9 great stands for flamboys to light the hall by night, and 7 behind the cross-bench, set at equal distances and even with the walls. The floor was paved with steatite, white and creamy, with veins of rich brown and black and purples and splashes of scarlet. The tables, resting on great trestles, were massy slabs of a dusky polished stone, powdered with sparks of gold as small as atoms. The women sat on the cross-bench, and midmost of them the Lady Presmyra, who outwent the rest in beauty and queenliness, as Venus the lesser planets of the night. Zenambria, wife to Duke Corsus, sat on her left, and on her right Sreva, daughter to Corsus, strangely fair for such a father. On the upper bench, to the right of the door, the lords of Witchland sat above and below the king's high seat, clad in holiday attire, and they of Pixieland had place over against them on the lower bench. The high seat on the lower bench was set apart for Lafayrie's. Great plates and dishes of gold and silver and painted porcelain were set in order on the tables, laden with delicacies. Harps and bagpipes struck up a barbaric music, and the guests rose to their feet as the shining doors swung open, and Gorais the king, followed by the prince his guest, entered that hall. Like a black eagle surveying earth from some high mountain, the king passed by in his majesty. His burnie was of black chain-mail, its collar, sleeves, and skirt edged with plates of dull gold set with hyacinths and black opals. His hose were black, cross-gartered with bands of sealskin trimmed with diamonds. On his left thumb was his great signet ring, fashioned in gold, in the semblance of the worm Ouroboros that eateth his own tail. The bezel of the ring, the head of the worm, made of a peach-colored ruby of the bigness of a sparrow's egg. His cloak was woven of the skins of black cobras, stitched together with gold wire, its lining of black silk, sprinkled with dust of gold. The iron crown of Witchland weighed on his brow, the claws of the crab erect like horns, and the sheen of its jewels was many-colored, like the rays of Sirius on a clear night of frost and wind at Yuletide. The Prince Lafayrise went in a mantle of black sendaline, sprinkled everywhere with spangles of gold, and the tunic beneath it of rich figured silk dyed deep purple of the pasque-flower. From the golden circlet on his head, two wings sprung aloft, exquisitely fashioned in plates of beaten copper, veneered with jewels and enamels, and plated with precious metals, to the semblance of the wings of the oleander hawk-moth. He was something below the common height, but stout and strong, and sturdily knit, with red, crisp, curly hair, broad-faced and ruddy, clean-shaved, with high, wide-nostrilled nose and bushy-red, heavy eyebrows, whence his eyes, most like his lady sister's, sea-green and fiery, shot glances like a lion's. When the king was come into his high seat, with Corund and Corineus on his left and right, in honour of their great deeds of arms, and Lafayrise facing him in the high seat on the lower bench, the thralls made haste to set forth dishes of pickled grigs and oysters in the shell, and wilks, snails, and cockles, fried in olive oil, and swimming in red and white hypocras. And the feasters delayed not to fall to on these dainties, while the cup-bearer bore round a mighty bowl of beaten gold, filled with sparkling wine the hue of the yellow sapphire, and furnished with six golden ladles, resting their handles in six half-moon-shaped nicks on the rim of that great bowl. Each guest, when the bowl was brought to him, must brim his goblet with the ladle, and drink unto the glory of Witchland and the rulers thereof. Somewhat greenly looked Corineus on the prince, and whispering Hemming, Corun's son, in the ear, who sat next him, he said, "True it is that Lafayrise is the showiest of men in all that belongeth to gear and costly array. Mark with what ridiculous excess he affecteth Demonland, in the great store of jewels he flaunteth, and with what an apish insolence he sitteth at the board. Yet this lobcock liveth only by our sufferance, and I see I hath not forgot to bring with him to Witchland the price of our hand withheld from twisting of his neck. Now were borne round dishes of carp, pilchards, and lobsters, and thereafter store anow of meats. A fat kid roasted whole and garnished with peas on a spacious silver charger. Kid pasties. Plates of neat's tongues and sweetbreads. Sucking rabbits in jellies. Hedgehogs baked in their skins. Hogs haslets. Carbonados, chitterlings, and dormouse pies. These and other luscious meats were borne round continually by thralls who moved silent on bare feet, and merry waxed the talk as the edge of hunger became blunted a little, and the cockles of men's hearts were warmed with wine.
"What news in Witchland?" asked Lafayrise.
"I have heard naught newer," said the king, "than the slaying of Gaslark."
And the king recounted the battle in the night, setting forth, as in a frank and open honesty, every particular of numbers, times, and comings and goings, save that none might have guessed from his tale that any of Demonland had part or interest in that battle. Lafayrise said,
Strange it is that he should so attack you. An enemy might smell some cause behind it.
Our greatness, said Corineus, looking haughtily at him, is a lamp whereat other moths than he have been burnt. I count it no strange matter at all.
Presmyra said,
Strange indeed were it any but Gaslark. But sure, with him no wild sudden fancy were too light, but it should chariot him like thistledown to storm heaven itself.
A bubble of the air, madam. All fine colours without, and empty wind within. I have known other such,
said Corineus, still resting his gaze with studied insolence on the prince. Presmyra's eye danced.
"Oh, my lord Corineus," said she, "change first thine own fashion, I pray thee, ere thou convince gay attire of inward folly, lest, beholding thee, we misdoubt thy precept or thy wisdom."
Corineus drank his cup to the drains and laughed. Somewhat reddened was his insolent, handsome face about the cheeks and shaven jowl, for surely was none in that hall more richly apparelled than he. His ample chest was cased in a jerkin of untanned buckskin, plated with silver scales, and he wore a collar of gold that was rough with smaragds, and a long cloak of sky-blue silk brocade lined with cloth of silver. On his left wrist was a mighty ring of gold, and on his head a wreath of black bryony and sleeping nightshade.
Grow whispered Corund in the ear.
He bibbeth it down apace, and the hour is yet early. This presageth trouble, since ever with him indiscretion treadeth hard on the heels of surliness as he waxeth drunken.
Corund grunted assent, saying aloud,
To all peaks of fame might Gaslark have climbed, but for this same rashness. Naught more pitiful hath been heard to tell of than his great sending into Impland 10 years ago, when, on a sudden conceit that I should lay all Impland under him and become the greatest king in all the world, he hired Zeldornius and Helteranius and Jalcanius Faustus,
the three most notable captains found on earth, said La Fierise.
Nothing is more true, said Corund. These he hired, and brought em ships and soldiers and horses and such a clutter of engines of war as has not been seen these 100 years, and sent em
whither?
To the rich and pleasant lands of Bestria?
No.
To Demonland?
Not a whit.
To this Witchland, where with a 20th part the power, I hath now risked all, and suffered death and doom?
No, but to yonder hell-besmitten wilderness of Upper Impland, treeless, waterless, not a soul to pay him tribute had he laid it under him, save wandering bands of savage imps, with more bugs on their bodies than pence in their purses, I warrant you. Or was he minded to be king among the divils of the air, ghosts and hob-thrushes that be found in that desert?
Without controversy, there be 17 several sorts of divils on the Maruna, said Corsus, very loud and sudden, so that all turned to look on him. Fiery divils, divils of the air, terrestrial divils, as you may say, and watery divils, and subterranean divils. Without controversy, there be 17 sorts, 17 several sorts of hob-thrushes, and several sorts of divils. And if the humour took me, I could name them all, by rote.
Wondrous solemn was the heavy face of Corsus. His eyes, baggy underneath and somewhat bloodshed, his pendulous cheeks, thick blubber upper lip, and bristly grey mustachios and whiskers. He had eaten, mainly to provoke thirst, pickled olives, capers, salted almonds, anchovies, fumados, and pilchards fried with mustard, and now awaited the salt chine of beef to be a pillow and a resting-place for new potations. The lady Zenambria asked,
"Knoweth any for certain what fate befell Jalcaneus and Helteranius and Zeldornius and their armies?"
"Heard I not," said Presmyra, "that they were led by Will-o'-the-Wisps to the regions Hyperborean, and there made kings?"
"Told thee by the Madge Howlet, I fear me, sister," said Lawfires. "When as I fared through Impland the Moor 6 years ago, there was many a wild tale told me hereof, but not within credit."
Now was the chine served in, amid shallots, on a great dish of gold, borne by 4 serving-men, so weighty was the dish and its burden. Some light there glowed in the dull eye of Corsus to see it come, and Corand rose up with brimming goblet, and the witches cried, "The song of the chine, O Corand!" Great as a neat stood Corand in his russet velvet kirtle, girt about with a broad belt of crocodile hide edged with gold. From his shoulders hung a cloak of wolf-skin with the hair inside, the outside tanned and diapered with purple silk. Daylight was nigh gone, and through a haze of savours rising from the feast, the flamboys shone on his bald head, set about with thick grizzled curls, and on his keen grey eyes, and his long and bushy beard. He cried,
"Give me a rouse, my lords, and if any fail to bear me out in the refrain, I'll ne'er love him more."
And he sang this song of the chine, in a voice like the sounding of a gong, and all they roared in the refrain, till the piled dishes on the service tables rang.
"Bring out the old chine, the cold chine to me, and how I'll charge him, come and see. Brawn tusked, brawn well soused and fine, with a precious cup of muscadine. How shall I sing, how shall I look, in honor of the master cook? The pig shall turn round and answer me, canst thou spare me a shoulder, wee wee? The duck, goose, and capon, good fellows all three, shall dance thee an antic, so shall the turkey. But oh, the cold chine for me! How shall I sing, how shall I look, in honor of the master cook? With Bruce I'll anoint thee from head to the heel, shall make thee run nimbler than the new oiled wheel. With pie crust we'll make thee the 8th wise man to be. But oh, the old chine, the cold chine for me! How shall I sing, how shall I look, in honor of the master cook?"
When the chine was carved, and the cups replenished, the king issued command, saying,
"Call hither my dwarf, and let him act his antic gestures before us."
Therewith came the dwarf into the hall, mopping and mowing, clad in a sleeveless jerkin of striped yellow and red macado, and his long and nerveless tail dragged on the floor behind him.
"Somewhat fulsome is this dwarf," said Lafayrise.
"Speak within door, prince," said Corineus. "Know'st not his quality? Ah, hath been envoy extraordinary from King Gorice the 11th of memory ever glorious, unto Lord Jus in Galing and the lords of Demonland. And 'twas the greatest courtesy we could study to give them, to send 'em this luby for our ambassador."
The dwarf practised before them, to the great content of the lords of Witchland and their guests, save for his japing upon Corineus and the prince, calling them 2 peacocks so like in their bright plumage that none might tell either from other, which somewhat galled them both. And now was the king's heart waxing glad with wine, and he pledged Gro, saying, "Be merry, Gro, and doubt not that I will fulfill my word I spake unto thee, and make thee king in Zajizakulo."
"Lord, I am yours for ever," answered Gro. "But methinks I am little fitted to be a king. Methinks I was ever a better steward of other men's fortunes than of mine own."
Whereat the Duke Corsus, that was sprawled on the table well nigh asleep, cried out in a great voice, but husky withal,
"A brace of devils, broil me, if thou sayest not sooth! If thine own fortunes come off but bluely, care not a rush. Give me some wine, a full weeping goblet. Ha, ha, whip it away. Ha, ha, Witchland! When wear you the crown of Demonland, O king?"
"How now, Corsus," said the king, "art thou drunk?" But Laufeyriz said, "Ye swear peace with the demons in the Foliot Isles, and by mighty oaths are ye bound to put by forever your claims of lordship over Demonland. I hoped your quarrels were ended."
"Why, so they are," said the king.
Corsus chuckled weakly.
"Ye say well, very well, O king, very well, Laufeyriz. Our quarrels are ended. No room for more. For look you, Demonland is a ripe fruit ready to drop me thus in our mouth."
Leaning back, he gaped his mouth wide open, suspending by one leg above it a hortelan basted with its own dripping. The bird slipped through his fingers and fell against his cheek and so on to his bosom and so on the floor, and his brazen burnie and the sleeves of his pale-grained kirtle were splashed with the gravy. Whereat Corineus let fly a great peal of laughter, but Laufeyriz flushed with anger and said, scowling, "Drunkenness, my lord, is a jest for thralls to laugh at."
"Then sit thou mum, prince," said Corineus, "lest thy quality be called in question. For my part, I laugh at my thoughts, and they be very choice."
But Corsus wiped his face and fell a-singing.
"Whene'er I bib the wine down, a sleep drop all my cares, a fig for fret, a fig for sweat, a fig care I for cares. Sith death must come, though I say nay, why grieve my life's days with affairs? Come bib we then the wine down of Bacchus fair to see, for always while we bibbing be, a sleep drop all our cares."
With that, Corsus sank heavily forward again on the table. And the dwarf, whose japes all else in that company had taken well, even when themselves were the mark thereof, leaped up and down, crying,
"Hear a wonder! This pudding singeth! When with two platters, thralls, ye have served it on the board without a dish. One were too little to contain so vast a deal of bullock's blood and lard. Swift and carve it ere the vapors burst the skin."
"I will carve thee, filth," said Corsus, lurching to his feet.
And catching the dwarf by the wrist with one hand, he gave him a great box on the ear with the other. The dwarf squealed and bit Corsus' thumb to the bone, so that he loosed his hold, and the dwarf fled from the hall, while the company laughed pleasantly.
"So flieth folly before wisdom which is in wine," said the king.
"The night is young. Bring me potagos and caviar and toast.
Drink, prince. The red Thramnian wine that is thick like honey wooeth the soul to divine philosophy. How vain a thing is ambition!" This was Gaslark's bane, whose enterprises of such pitch and moment have ended thus in a kind of nothing. Or what thinkest thou, Gro, thou which art a philosopher?
"Alas, poor Gaslark," said Gro. "Had all grown to his mind, and had he, gainst all expectation, gotten us overthrown, even so had he been no nearer to his heart's desire than when he first set forth. For he had of old, in Zajizakulo, eating and drinking and gardens and treasure and musicians and a fair wife, all soft ease and contentment all his days. And at the last, howsoe'er we shape our course, cometh the poppy that abideth all of us by the harbour of oblivion, hard to cleanse. Dry withered leaves of laurel or of cypress tree, and a little dust. Naught else remaineth."
"With a sad brow I say it," said the king. "I hold him wise that resteth happy, even as the red foliot, and tempteth not the gods by overmounting ambition to his dejection."
La Fieries had thrown himself back in his high seat, with his elbows resting on its lofty arms, and his hands dangling idly on either side. With head held high and incredulous smile, he hearkened to the words of Gorice the king. End of part 2 of chapter 7.